kwakuwang kwamnyako nawubu nawundukufu andamilele.
Broadcasting from high above the reserve, this is Radio Harambe. Jambo, everyone, and thank you once again for tuning in to Radio Harambe, the companion podcast or our website, jamboeveryone.com. I am Dave McBride, broadcasting, as always, from the Radio Harambe studios, and joining me from somewhere in the world, it's Safari Mike. Mike, how are you tonight?
Hey, Dave, how are you?
At least it's night here. I don't know where it is where you are.
Well, I'm in the Kwai Noa River.
The what? Spell it.
All right. K H W A
K H
W A E, and Noir is N O I.
K H W K sounds African, but N O I does not. So, what else could be K H W A? Are you sure?
Right. K-H-W-A-E.
A-E! Oh, that changes everything.
Yeah, I said E.
Oh, I thought you said I didn't hear the E. Okay, so K-H-W-A-E. I'm going to say Asia.
Okay. So far, so good.
That sounds a lot like Kwai.
Okay.
I don't know. Is that the Asian version of the English version of Kwai, the River Kwai, by any chance?
Dave, I am in Thailand.
Well, that could be the same river. I don't know. Does the River Kwai go that far?
We're here studying the bumblebee bat, Dave. That is the smallest mammal on Earth.
Really?
It weighs just about 2 grams. They roost in about 100 of them. Roost together. They come out and feed on insects and mosquitoes and things like that.
Crazy. But
they're highly endangered, and they're only found in a small areas here in western Thailand.
Now, are they endangered because of deforestation and things like that? And
well, yes.
Because they're so localized?
They're so localized, that's number one. And they do, you know, there's deforestation and burning of the forest. And there's also pollution from cement factories that are common here in western Thailand.
Oh, yeah. Well, you get that with these very localized populations. I mean, if there's not a gigantic national park surrounding it, which there may very well be, you know, still that is no guarantee. Cool. The smallest mammal in the world.
Correct.
The bumblebee bat.
The bumblebee bat.
Very cool. Well, on this show, Mike and I are going to discuss the news, of which there isn't much from the animal kingdom. We go with what we have, and also from the rest of Walt Disney World. And then our final segment, for those of you who listened to our last episode, you would have heard the first part of an interview we did with Matt from Wedway Radio about what I call the prehistoric Disney's animal kingdom, basically the origins of the park, where Matt and myself and Mike started really at the beginning for Walt, and how this idea of animals and realism nurtured itself over years to eventually become the animal kingdom. We only got as far as the opening of Disneyland, basically got to World War II, and didn't really pick up much there. So the second part of that interview is only really going to be about early Disneyland with myself, Mike, and Matt. And you're just going to hear our conversation about how you could see some of the animals and things like that in Disneyland, early Disneyland, that had their influence upon the animal kingdom. Now, Mike, we're going to do just one news segment here because there really only is one local story. And that is one that I wasn't even aware of until today, which is that you have seen some, I believe you said you saw these, some photographs on Twitter of these hyenas who we reported about a few weeks ago. showing up, on, I guess, in the examination room at Rafiki's Planet Watch?
Correct. Yeah, they were having their quarantine exam at Rafiki's Planet Watch. Oh, it was probably a little over a week now. You know, this is an exam that they do, you know, while the or shortly before the animal goes into quarantine. And at the Animal Kingdom, as well as most zoos, there's a period of quarantine before the animals are actually put on some type of exhibit. You know, I remember where the Sumatran tiger, who is now out, the female, was on quarantine exhibit probably a good 3 or 4 weeks before she actually made her debut on exhibit. So,
right.
You know, so that should tell you when they plan on maybe putting the hyenas out.
Now, for those who weren't listening back, I wouldn't say it's midsummer, you know, the end of July, beginning of August, sometime around then, we reported about hyenas coming to the Animal Kingdom. The University of California at Berkeley had been keeping a, just to kind of review a little bit, had been keeping a captive research colony of the of spotted hyenas for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And funding had fallen apart for these this colony, and they began placing these animals in different zoos, and the Animal Kingdom picked up a couple and brought them in. I want to say, did we say there was three or something? I can't remember the number.
How many hyenas?
Yeah.
Three, because I mean, I suspect it has something to do with the fact that there were three hyenas were the focus of Lion King.
Right. But right. I really hope that's not the reason, but let's not rehash that. So if you go back to our JohnBoyEveryone.com and just search in hyena, you'll see the article from earlier. I actually just found it on August 6th, where we tell you all about where they come from, and the whole situation behind UCal Berkeley and these kind of things. There's a lot to this story. So it's going to be really cool. We still don't know, right, Mike? We still don't know where they're going to go.
I have no idea. I don't know if they're going to find a spot for them on Pangani, which is currently undergoing a fairly extensive refurbishment. So maybe they're
that makes sense.
Yeah, putting something there. I don't know if they would go somewhere on the Kilimanjaro Safari. I mean, they could. Obviously, the hyenas are not going to be mingled in with zebras and antelope. But, you know, there might be a spot for them there somewhere. It's hard to say right now where they're going to go.
Yeah, so we have yet to hear. So I like your theory about the about Pangani, because the reopening of some of these areas may coincide with this lag in time that they need for to be quarantined. So, you know, that makes sense. So they're you know, now starting to put all these things together. So that's it for the local news. Exciting stuff. Always like to hear that.
One second there, Dave.
Yeah.
For local news, I mean, this is not really news, but I know it is the season of it's fall, and of course it's Halloween season, and there are a bunch of different specialty desserts being bandied about in terms of. Kusafiri has like this Minnie Mouse mug with chocolate mousse in it. It's a pumpkin shaped.
Right.
And there's like a creepy, you know, gummy worms and ice cream sundae at the Discover Island ice cream place. There's also the bat cupcake in Discover Island as well. Do we know, is Bat Day coming on October 31st? Because I haven't heard diddly squat. That's almost always Halloween for they do a special Bat Day.
It is almost always Halloween. I assume that it is. Let me see if I can find it real quick. It has always been in the past, like Mike's saying.
Yeah, I couldn't find any reference to it. I looked real quick while we were talking.
Yeah. Huh. I'm trying to find the old article I did about all of those days to see if that was in there. I would expect it to be. the only thing I can find is one on Oh no, that's 2013.
Mm-hmm.
yeah, I don't see anything yet. So we'll see. We'll you know check on that and see what they plan on doing.
Yeah, but I haven't seen any reference to it. Usually by now, they will tell you. I wonder if they're not doing it this year. I don't know. Yeah,
because the Parks blog has been doing quite a bit of the Halloween prep stuff.
Yeah.
Tomorrow we're recording this on a Tuesday. They usually do their Animal Kingdom animal type stuff on Wednesdays. A little Wildlife Wednesday thing.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it'll be up tomorrow and we'll know more. You'll know more when you hear this than we actually know. So,
But it is commonly done on Halloween. The last at least, what, 5-6 years, I would
certainly,
think.
Certainly. Yep, absolutely.
It's always Halloween, for obvious reasons. I mean, Bat Day, Halloween, bats correct. Are, you know, vampires, whatever.
Correct.
So, yeah, but I'm surprised I haven't seen anything. I recall when they listed, like, this year's things, I remember you and I talking about how, you know, Bat Day wasn't listed for some reason. So, I don't know.
Yeah,
we'll have to see.
That'll stink. Bat Day has been a tradition. So what's in the world news while we're into news mode?
Sure, Dave. Well, we're going to go to Italy as well as, the beach club. But first, let's go to Adventureland, where...
I like Adventureland.
I do, too. And the Island Supply, which is one of those gift shops that are, you know, around the Aladdin area. You know what I'm talking about, the spinning ride.
Right.
That's closing tomorrow. Actually, October 22nd. So by the time this is out, it'll be closed. And the new store will be opening later in the year. No exact word on what the store will be called or what the concept will be. But rumor has it that, as you know, Dave, the co-op at Downtown Disney is sort of the testing ground for merchandise.
Right.
And they've been selling a lot of tiki-related merchandise there since they opened. Mugs, plates, that kind of stuff. And apparently they've been selling well, so it's theorized that this smaller shop over in the Adventureland will reopen to some sort of tiki-inspired gift shop with all of or much of that merchandise that you had there, you know, being for sale in this area.
I hope so, because that shop, I was kind of disappointed to see that shop was closing. That again is one of the few shops left that doesn't sell Frozen plush. You know, it was it even to this day would sell like Hawaiian shirts and surfer t-shirts and, you know, kind of different things there. Mm-hmm. Besides, you know, tropical themed Disney stuff. So when I saw that it was closing, I thought I hope you're right. I hope they at least are using the proper theme there for the shop and not just turning into your average, you know, gift shop. Because where it's situated, it's like it wouldn't really be a shop for any particular ride, so it's going to have to be
right.
a catch-all shop for some reason or another.
Right.
So
yeah, but it would make sense to have tiki stuff in there.
Yeah,
and the stuff they were selling was, to be honest, kind of cool. So you know, I think and well received. So
yes,
makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. But I don't know why it would have to completely close for that amount of time to change what you're selling. But you know,
well, they'll probably change the sign. They'll probably change maybe the look of the interior to some degree.
Yeah.
I mean, it is October 22nd and opening by the end later this year. I mean, we're only talking about a two month break. So that's not really all that much. I mean, the year's almost over.
But it's more, it's going to obviously be more than just merchandise change. It's going to be,
correct.
they're going to do some changes to the right. aesthetics of the place as well. So cool.
Over in Epcot, Dave, Italy, which has recently began soft opening, I guess, for lack of a better term, the flag waving performance that they will be that's going to go on there now.
Right.
I'm not even going to try to pronounce the name of this particular performance. It is very long with lots of vowels. I don't know how to pronounce it. I'll leave it up to the listener.
I'll say Spandieratori di...
Alrighty.
San Sepolcro. That's the bad one.
Yeah, the blessed one is really tough.
San Sepolcro?
I guess.
It has to be San Sepolcro.
They really picked a tongue twister for the name, which it seems unusual.
It does.
Most guests will have no idea how to even say it. It'll be fun listening to people as they walk around World Showcase trying to pronounce.
Sure.
The name. But it recently soft opened. It's basically guys, and you could see online some video of it. I'm a little, I don't know, doesn't really seem like my kind of thing. But basically, it's guys in Renaissance-like type of costumes, very colorful with very colorful flags,
right?
Twirling them around. Obviously, they're talented, and there's some musicians to, you know, a couple of flutes and drums that are playing as this is all going on.
Yeah, I saw like fanfare kind of looking trumpet things. And
yeah, it's about a 12-minute show.
Really?
It's going on for about, and there's about, right now, there's about seven different performances from 11:20 to about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I don't know.
Is it better than the Lumberjack Show?
Well, Dave, I mean, somebody, you know, making armpit noises was better than the Lumberjack Show at this point.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this is something at least I might look at and give it a shot. But just on video, it's not really floating my boat.
No, I mean, it's colorful. Mm-hmm. It makes for good photographs. It's kind of pretty. I'll admit I haven't seen the video of it yet, so I'm not going to say too much. There was, you know, it's cute. I mean, it's fine.
Seems like the kind of thing that you might better appreciate if you're actually watching it in person on a video online.
Probably, because there's a lot of guys throwing around a lot of flags, and it's a grandiose, a much bigger production, you know, a grand entrance rather than just five guys coming up on a stage and tossing an axe around.
Right.
Which is very underwhelming looking. This is not. This is, you know, and it's interactive. They get. I've seen pictures of, you know, guests in there with them and stuff like that. Not a lot of guests. It doesn't seem like it's all that. I mean, for one thing, who's going to look at that time guide and look at that name and say, oh boy, I got to see that? I mean, I don't even know what it is.
Yeah, you have no idea what
and
it is.
Flag waving show. Who looks at an unpronounceable name with the caption flag waving show and says, oh boy, we got to make sure we see that. I mean, it just
Not event, as they say, event television, you know, it's not,
yeah.
If you're walking by and you happen to catch it, maybe you sit there for a couple of minutes and watch it. Yeah. But you know, there's a lot of that stuff at Epcot that's like that. I mean, other than Off Kilter, really, who like looked at the times guide to really find out, you know, who's playing what. You know, you would, like, for example, the guy in France who would stack the chairs.
Right.
I had no idea when that guy was on, but if I was walking by and I saw him, I might watch him for a couple minutes. You know, it's that kind of thing, I think. It's not going to be something that people are, oh, you know, there's that 11:20 showing of the flag waving performance. Let's scurry on over to Italy.
Right. I mean, that's the problem with this taking the place of the bands. You know, even the British band that's there now, mm-hmm. I guess, is still there. We haven't heard about this change because they announced a change. But they, even the, you know, if you like the kind of music, you're going to stop and listen to it. You're going to see it. And then if you don't, you know, I mean, I used to come back and see them all the time. But if you don't, the next time you come, you could be mm-hmm. sure you're going to see a different show of some regard. You may not see a completely different show. There may be a couple of songs that you recognize from the last time, but you'll see a different show. With this kind of thing, though, you kind of see it once and you've seen it. You know?
But this wasn't replacing a band, though. Don't forget.
No. I just mean this kind of show in general. And you made your point about the France show as well. The reason why bands and improv worked was because, you know, improv comedy was because those things can change. So they had sort of stayability.
Repeatability.
Right. So this doesn't have that. I mean, maybe it does. I don't know. It doesn't look that way from what I see. The Lumberjacks don't seem to have that either. I don't know why they chose these things. I mean, whoever's in charge of the entertainment recently really should go start looking for a job at Six Flags.
All right, well, shall we move on?
Yeah.
Not far from there, of course, is the Beach Club, which is going down for a major Polynesian-like refurbishment beginning later this year.
Okay, I heard that the Beach Club was going down for refurbishment. I did not hear that it was going down for a Polynesian refurbishment.
It's going to be down. It's going to be refurbished for about 20 months.
To turn into a resort, the Polynesian.
Yes.
I'm like, the way you said that, Mike, I thought you meant it was going to become like a tiki place.
No. But it's going under a humongous refurbishment.
Now I see what you mean. Okay.
There's going to be a lot of walls, much like the Polynesian. It's going to be 20 months. A lot of it's going to be remodeled. I know all the guest rooms are going to be refurbished periodically. But like public areas are going to go down periodically for various refurbishment. The theme obviously will probably stay the same, I'm sure, but it's going to have a different look, a different color scheme, perhaps. But it'll be open throughout. You know, if you're staying at the Beach Club over that beginning, you know, later this year, for about 20 months, there'll be walls, you know, around where you are. I don't think it's going to be a fundamental change like the Polynesian look, like the whole lobby being completely different. But there's going to be a lot of work being done to it.
I'm not sure it needed it. I mean, that didn't. It seemed to be holding up pretty well to me.
Yeah, I guess.
But unless they have some great ideas for something new. I mean, I don't know. Until we know for sure. It's one of these things where they charge so much money for these hotels. I'm surprised they're so cavaliering about such long refurbishment times. I mean,
yeah, I mean, it's one thing to refurbish the rooms. I mean, you could, if you really want to go through and refurbish the rooms, which is perfectly fine. I mean, it happens all the time. You got to change the furniture out and all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
I mean, you can close wings at a time and nobody would really know because nobody would be staying in that particular, right, you know, floor, wing, whatever. But they're changing public areas too. They're redoing a lot of the public areas. So it's going to affect your stay there for sure.
Yeah, it has. It's funny that they would choose that and as opposed to the yacht club or any of those other things. So I read about this today and it's interesting to see that they're putting so much time and effort into these things. But the word of the year, refurbishment.
Yeah, apparently.
At the end. Did I also hear that the Little Mermaid's closing for a lengthy refurbishment?
About a month, yeah.
Oh, that's not that lengthy.
No.
Okay. No. Cool. Is that it?
None more.
What's it? What do we got?
One of the probably most popular rumors in the Disney World blog world is the quote-unquote fifth gate. Well, it's reared its ugly head again within the last couple of weeks.
Oh, boy.
Disney has announced that the Flamingo Crossings, the until now dead in the water area up north of Animal Kingdom, where they announced this years ago, as this new space where outside vendors can come in and buy property and build their own hotels and all that kind of stuff. Well, nobody was buying
into. Nobody did that.
Yeah, nobody did that. Whatever rates they were charging were not suitable for people such as Marriott. But apparently that's changing as a couple of Marriotts are coming in and perhaps as many as, you know, six or seven new hotels and new areas are coming in this Western Way, you know, Route 429 area, which is a little north and a little west of the Animal Kingdom.
Is it going to be a frozen gate?
There's no rumors as to what the gate would actually be, but for some reason, I can't figure this out, the rumor that of a fifth gate is stemming from the fact that Disney has gotten Marriott to build a few hotels over here. So somehow logically, I guess that means that, you know, there's a good chance that a fifth gate is coming within the next, you know, 8 to 10 years. WDWNT thinks one will be built before 2021. I personally don't think there's any chance in hell we're ever getting a fifth gate.
I don't think that quickly. And I don't think just because they've made a deal with Marriott that means that they need that Marriott is making, you know, that they're promising Marriott prime location on a new theme park. I mean,
right, because the fifth gate would be right next to that almost.
Yeah, I mean, I think with the amount of money they're going to have to put into the Hollywood studios and the amount of money that they are putting into the Animal Kingdom, I don't see that. I'm with you. I don't see that.
I don't see where Iger, you know, we criticize Iger in the past for various things, but one thing he is not is stupid.
Right.
And makes bad decisions. What on earth, what is the possible benefit of building a fifth park for the Disney company? I mean, obviously it's beneficial for guests because, you know, they want to have a all villains theme park or a Frozen Land, as you said, or whatever it is. Florida Adventure. What's the possible benefit?
The only reason why I would say he's going to build a park would be because he's going to build a Star Wars park. Because there, if you think about the Hollywood studios and the different movie properties that they could put into there, you know, if they're figuring, oh boy, Frozen's a big deal, and maybe we could do a Wreck-It Ralph section and maybe make the Hollywood studios to be more of a Disney, you know, Disney's Hollywood Adventure, as you said, more of a kid-related film type thing when they do the makeover, you know. or at least try to put some more of those in there, like the Cars Land and all the other things that we hear, you know, the Ratatouille and all that kind of stuff, and really focus on the Pixar, then maybe a real overly themed Star Wars area would be – might be a bit limiting for that, if you know
what
I mean.
Yeah, it's so a Star Wars park.
But my point is if you take Star Wars –
yeah.
Especially if the next films are a success, the possibilities for what you can do attraction-wise in Star Wars is gigantic. So if they wanted to make a fifth gate, I really think that'd be the only thing they could possibly do, is to make a Star Wars-only thing, because they feel like they have too many ideas that they can use and they wouldn't really be getting their full money's worth without really focusing a lot of area onto Star Wars that maybe they just don't feel they have at the Hollywood studios, you know?
The problem with that, though, is I can't imagine they would build a park over one franchise.
I mean,
I know Star Wars is big, and you could maybe get away with it. I mean, that and Harry Potter, I guess if you built, like, a whole park that was just based on Harry Potter or Star Wars, I just don't see Disney building a whole theme park based upon one franchise. But the real issue I have with all of this is... it really doesn't make financial sense for Disney to build a fifth theme park, because they've already the vast, vast majority of guests who go to Disney World go for a week. They're there from, you know, Saturday to Saturday or Sunday to Sunday, usually right. Saturday to Saturday. Right. You have about 6 days. They have four theme parks. They have two water parks. Most people go maybe for a second day at the Magic Kingdom. The week is already occupied. You're only cannibalizing your own guests.
That's why I agree with you. That's why I agree with you that it's probably not going to happen.
Personally, this may not be a popular opinion. Personally, I don't think it's ever going to happen.
No, I wouldn't imagine it would.
I mean, unless the way people vacation changes, you know, over time. And, you know, people more often take 2 weeks than not. But with the expense of a Disney vacation, that's never going to happen for Disney.
Yeah, no, I don't think so either. No. Like I said, the only thing I could possibly see them doing is building a, you know, a smaller kind of park, you know, like the Hollywood Studios originally was.
I could see a boutique park. You mean like that? Yeah. Like the park that SeaWorld built that's very specialized, very expensive, and you swim with dolphins?
Yeah.
I could see something like that. That's not out of the realm of possibility. That's true.
So could you do a boutique park on Star Wars?
See, they need Star Wars to fix Hollywood Studios.
I don't agree with that entirely. A lot of people, I hear that opinion a lot, and I understand it, and I guess to some degree I share it. But I think that there are enough Disney films in the canon where they could, you know, if they did rides for all, you know, more of the Pixar films, you know, if they did, you know, not just the Cars Land thing, but also put in the Ratatouille thing, you know, maybe
some Monsters Inc. door coaster,
do a Monsters Inc. thing, maybe go back and do some, since it was Disney's Hollywood Studios, maybe go back and revisit some of the older ones, do a Fantasia kind of thing or something like that. You know, they could certainly do rides on the history of Disney animation, and it would be, you know, a park based around Disney's, you know, Walt's films as well, and the Disney mm-hmm. animation thing, because as I say, and as I've said a million times, Star Wars isn't Disney. And so I don't see how, if you're going to do Disney's Hollywood Adventure and you're going to put Pixar and all this stuff in it, I don't see where a Star Wars land fits in that, other than the fact that it'd be really good. But,
that park has always relied on other... I mean, it started off with MGM. Wizard of Oz is not Disney either, and that was a focus point of that park to begin with.
Right, but if you're talking about telling a story, and that's what Imagineers always want to do in a park, and that's what happened to Hollywood Studios, right? They got away from the story. And the more and more they got away from the story, the worse and worse the park became aesthetically. If you want to tell a story... and the story is Disney's Hollywood Adventure, I don't see where Star Wars fits in that story. That's my only point. So I wouldn't be totally blown away if the fifth gate was going to be Star Wars and that Hollywood Studios was going to be, you know, tell the you know, more about Disney films.
Mm.
Because in the space I've been hearing for what they can do with Star Wars, it's just going to be a limiting thing. You're only going to have one or two attractions at the most, you know, and maybe a restaurant. It doesn't have a space. Rather than, I mean, think about what you could do with the fifth gate of Star Wars, right, Mike? You can have Tatooine, you can have Hoth, you can have, I mean, think of all the lands that you can put in. You know,
right? I guess, but I mean, I hearken back. I mean, Disney talks about how great Frozen is, and all they're doing is like a cheap overlay of Maelstrom.
Right, but let's say Frozen. I'm totally wrong about Frozen, and it becomes one of the greatest films of all time in the Disney history. It's already not that, but let's just say it is. And they want to do that at the Hollywood Studios. Okay, that makes sense. You know, maybe they come up with another hit. Maybe they want to, you know, maybe they want to do a WALL-E thing too, and you know, Wreck-It Ralph, or what, like we were saying. I mean, there's a lot of things they could do. Star Wars doesn't fit into that to me. So it'd be another. We would just be taking a bad hodgepodge and turning it into a better hodgepodge, but we'd still have a hodgepodge. We wouldn't have that kind of story that ties everything together like you do in the other parks. That's the that's the only point I make out of it. But I, having said all that, Fifth Gate is not going to happen. Yeah, Mike is 100% right.
They just don't see it.
Yeah, there's just no any reason for it right now. You'd just be taking your own guests, as you said.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the problem. When Animal Kingdom opened, that was part of the issue, was that it was really cannibalizing their own guests for most part.
Unless they think we're going to kill Harry Potter at studios because we're not just building a land for Star Wars. We're building the greatest, you know, single movie thing ever.
Right.
You know, but I really don't see it happening. I don't see it happening. But it's interesting that this thing keeps popping up because every few years it seems we do have this.
Well, ever since Animal Kingdom opened in 1998, there were rumors of the fifth park because before that it was the fourth gate. I mean, so I think it's always going to be a rumor.
Yeah, and especially with an outgoing CEO.
Yeah.
You never know. Cool.
All right.
Is that it?
That is it.
Well, that's it for the news, folks. We are going to take a short break here. And when we come back, you're going to hear the second part of our discussion with Matt from Wedway Radio about the origins of Disney's Animal Kingdom. And this is going to be all about the early part of Disneyland. So when we come back from a break, you're going to hear us kind of get into the middle of this conversation a little bit. We're just going to kind of really cut it off right when the last one finished. If you want to go back and listen to that, please do so. And then the next subject's going to start. So you're not going to hear any intro or anything like that. You're just going to, right after this short break, you're going to hear us pop right back in as soon as the music is done. But take a listen. It was great, great stuff, just like everything Matt does, and we can't thank him enough. So stay tuned, and we'll be back in just a minute. Jennifer Green of Destinations in Florida is the official travel partner of Radio Harambe and JomboEveryone.com. Jen can do everything you need done in order to book your next Walt Disney World vacation and have the time of your life. She is an expert in everything Disney and will remove all the stress of booking your trip. And she is as committed to conservation as we are. So every vacation you book, or even every quote you request, means Jen and Destinations in Florida will make a donation to the Jombo Everyone conservation effort. You can contact Jen directly by emailing her at jennifer.g@destinationsinflorida.com or by calling her directly at 443-424-0181. You can also head over to jomboeveryone.com and click the Destinations in Florida icon to get your vacation started. Seriously, what can be better than booking a Disney World vacation while helping to save wildlife? Also touch in sort of the early stages of Disneyland. Now we're getting into things that, you know, you really can see a thread with the Animal Kingdom here in the sort of prehistoric era of the Animal Kingdom. So let's talk about Disneyland a little bit. Now, Matt, neither Mike nor I have been to to Disneyland.
Oh, you're killing me.
So this is reason number...
You East Coasters.
So as we've already... We brought you on because you know more about Walt than either of us and the early animation, and because you've actually been to this thing that we need to talk about.
Okay, that does help, I guess. Although some of the things that we're going to be talking about, I never experienced, so.
Long since gone.
Yes, they've been gone since like 1960, but we can still talk about them.
I think if you're going to talk about the Animal Kingdom and relation to Walt and the history of the company, you really can't talk about Disneyland without starting at the Jungle Cruise.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if there's one attraction in Disney history which stands as the true precursor to the Animal Kingdom, it is the Jungle Cruise. And as far as I understand it, Walt either wanted or at least discussed the possibility of having real animals, and instead, for, you know, I don't know, cost reasons or, you know, the difficulty of keeping animals, instead went with audio animatronics. So let me start there. Matt, is that true or is that urban legend?
I think it's fairly true to say that, you know, maybe Walt probably had big dreams for lots of these areas, and we'll kind of talk about some areas where they did use live animals. But I think with the Jungle Cruise specifically, those types of animals would not have worked well. And regardless of whether he wanted them, I think that maybe Roy and some other pragmatic people in the company were probably pushing him away from many of those ideas.
Now, I think what a lot of people forget, and the real thread here through history, is that at that time in the 1950s, you know, we weren't far off from real explorers in the world. You know, the less than 100 years beforehand, you had things like Livingston and Burton and Speke, and, you know, people climbing the Himalayas. And, you know, there was still exploration going there. There was Shackleton, people still going throughout the world, you know, only in Walt's lifetime, you know, doing these things. So the Jungle Cruise is not just animals and a depiction of animals, which we'll get to, but also this idea that's very big in the Animal Kingdom itself of exploring the world.
Yes.
And exploring the far reaches of the world.
For sure, for sure. And it's not a rumor that the early scripts for the Animal King, or excuse me, for the Jungle Cruise, they were not tongue-in-cheek, right? They were more serious.
Right.
And so, yeah, with that in mind, it's the voyage, it's the journey, it's the sort of Jules Verne-esque, or like you said, Shackleton exploration of different parts of the earth, where, you know, if you grew up in Los Angeles or in Missouri, where I am, or wherever, there's no way you would have ever seen these areas because you didn't even have television until the 40s.
Right.
So, you know, the idea that sort of Disney was taking you through this expedition was just as important as the animals itself. I think that's the fun of it, is that it's a voyage.
There was still quite the fascination, even at that time, with exploring Africa and, you know, some of the far reaches and, you know, the Nile and all these places. But, Mike, I want to talk with you about the animals for a second, because we Matt mentioned the tongue-in-cheek thing. Obviously, the animals are depicted in a sort of silly way in a lot of them, but not entirely silly. Like, some of them are still kind of well researched and well made.
You mean like the lions eating the zebra and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, that I think of I mean that's
the animals themselves in the Jungle Cruise are not necessarily cartoony looking.
Right
They are realistic looking. They're just sort of in cartoony situations, for lack of a better word. So I agree with you. I mean, they went out of their way to make them look real, but the lions and the zebra and the wildebeest and the rhinos.
The rhinos,
the elephants look great, and you know, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, they just have them in sort of funny situations.
It was the first time that I can think of that Walt recreated animals or used animals in there as realistic as he possibly could, you know, in a theme park attraction.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because this is a day one attraction, guys. I mean, it's, you know, when you go back to the, you know, Dateline Disneyland opening day special, you see that, you know, the Jungle Cruise is supposed to be a big part of your experience at Disneyland. I mean, it's supposed to be a signature, if not the signature attraction at the park. And in many respects, it was supposed to encompass a larger area, possibly. I mean, so you had this real push for this attraction. And then within the attraction, of course, you want to have authentic looking animals. So if you go to the Disneyland TV shows that document the building of these animals and what they would look like in different environments, I mean, they really paid a great deal of attention to detail in terms of, you know, what do two elephants look like when they're, you know, sucking up water and spraying it on each other? What do they really look like? And they did a nice job of that.
What does the inside of a hippo's mouth look like?
Oh, no kidding,
exactly,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so, I mean, that's fascinating to me.
Yeah, so, I mean, so you have zoos. You know, it's not like you don't have zoos at this time. Mm-hmm. But you don't necessarily have any kind of interaction in a zoo with the animals themselves. You really can't get that close. And it's not part of any expedition other than you sort of walking around a pen where an animal would be. So in this, you know, I love that you mentioned the voyage part, because that really is sort of the linchpin of this attraction, is sort of going through the different environments where these animals would be.
Right. And you would, yeah, you would think at that point in time, the zoos were basically steel cages.
Totally.
You'd see a lion sleeping in a steel cage or a hippo or whatever. This was really the only opportunity for people to sort of see the animals as they really should be in their environments. That and TV, which, you know, many people obviously didn't even have.
Right.
Yeah, yeah,
right.
That was the next place I was going to go with that, is that it was really the first chance. You know, it was the beginning of not just animals, you know, in a realistic, you know, habitat. But I mean, it's the beginning of that for so many different things. I mean, it's the first time, it's the first safari ride, and how many zoos and, you know, safari parks are there across the country now?
You know? Oh yeah.
And that's where you could really start the timeline from, certainly in the Disney respect, but not just in the Disney respect.
Yeah, right. Definitely. I went to, are you familiar with Grant's Farm?
I am not. No.
Okay, no. So Ulysses S. Grant, right, owned mm-hmm. this patch of land in St. Louis. We won't talk a lot about St. Louis because we don't need to. But
oh, here we go.
This area is now owned by Anheuser-Busch, and they have actually a really neat little Anheuser-Busch / Grant's Farm attraction. And within this particular land is a little safari voyage. And I believe this was actually built in 54, 55, or 56, right around the same time as Disneyland, where you're actually going through this particular environment. I don't know how far back that, you know, the little safari ride dates, but the animals that you see are not hippopotamuses, they're not giraffes, they're not elephants, but they're things that you would find in North America or whatever, and you can drive near them and it's not a big deal. So this wasn't, you know, altogether odd or new per se, but because they did it in a sort of comprehensive way where you're immersed in this environment, it is different and innovative.
And I also wanted to mention the other thing about the Jungle Cruise is the environment. And what I mean is this. You can see the queue for Cali River Rapids. The ideas for that beginning at the Jungle Cruise. You could see, I mean, for God's sake, they wear the same outfit that the safari truck drivers wear in the Animal Kingdom, practically, you know, at the Animal Kingdom. There's so many aesthetic threads between the Animal Kingdom and the Jungle Cruise.
Oh, yeah.
Mike, you could speak more to that than I could, you being our theme spotlight guy.
Oh, God.
But you see where I'm saying, what I'm saying there? I mean, there are mm-hmm. there are the temple, the Asian temple that's there. There's sure. all sorts of examples of that in that ride.
Oh, and maybe the most important thing about that is the original plans for the Asia section of Animal Kingdom was to have a boat ride where you saw actual animals from an Asian rainforest. You know, I think in many ways Disney was sort of, you know, let's do Jungle Cruise, but with real animals for real here in the Animal Kingdom. Obviously, it never really took hold and they had to change their plans. But, you know, that was clearly that was what they wanted to do from the get-go.
And Adventureland itself, the aesthetic of Adventureland in itself, also has some qualities. Now, mm-hmm. I'm thinking of Adventureland in Disney World. I have never been to the one in Disneyland. So we would
it's, just,
need...
it's a little more confined. It's not as space. You know, there's that sort of tie to Florida in the adventure land of Walt Disney World with the Orange Bird, etc. Whereas okay. at Disneyland, you don't really have that. You have these sort of smaller walkways. It's a much more intimate setting between storefronts and attractions. And because of where the Tiki Room is and how it's designed, it's just much more it feels like it has more character, I think, because you're much more immersed in that space.
And I think of the thatched roofs.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Totally.
The African art, the artwork that's there. I mean, it looks like the beginnings of Harambe to me.
Yes. You know what's weird is this, is there's always this discussion when people look back at Walt Disney World and you hear Walt say that, you know, they had the blessing of size, right? They had the space to do everything they wanted to do. And in some ways, it sort of worked against them. And so when you get to the Animal Kingdom, you can see that in certain areas they did close in walkways with trees around and storefront sort of jutting out into the mm-hmm. walkways. And I think that's the strength of Disneyland, is that it has that. The only problem with Disneyland is that there's no traffic control. I mean, there's so many people and so much limited space that Adventureland is, you know, from here to the wall. Whereas at Animal Kingdom, they have an entire park where they're able to do this. And so, you know, the space works for them there in a different way.
Now, when we talk about early Animal Kingdom, early Disneyland, you mentioned something that you wanted to discuss, and that is the actual use of live animals in early Disneyland.
Yes, and so this is something that I don't know that everyone that goes to Disneyland sort of realizes this today, is that you had in Frontierland a large, very large space where different live animals were used as part of the story and part of the journey. And so you had attractions like the Mule Pack, where you're literally getting on a mule, and a mule is a great animal. I don't know if you have much experience with mules, but a mule
no,
is
not
a great
New
animal.
Jersey. We don't have a whole lot of experience with mules.
A mule is a heck of an animal. So these mules, these poor things, right? People load up and go on these little safaris around this, you know, dirt track here with these mules. And they were able to tie in, you know, live animals here to Frontierland. And this is sort of the area of Disneyland's early days that are, you know, kind of overshadowed by the Jungle Cruise, is that you actually had live animals there. It wasn't just mules. You also had the stagecoach.
Yeah.
Yep. And so you had horses, and that was really tricky. I know the horses were spooked a lot, but probably a liability issue. But, you know, Nate and I on Wedway Radio, we did the I don't know if you're familiar with our 1.0 series.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so we've been able to sort of explore lots of these different attractions here where live animals were used. And so Frontierland was really the space where you had lots of live animals. And that didn't really last very long. They found that using live animals wasn't very good for business.
When I see early pictures of Disneyland, the thing that blows my mind is the people sitting on top of the stagecoaches.
Oh, it's scary.
I just cannot believe somebody thought that was a good idea.
I know. I'll go to zoos today and I see people like getting on camels or like elephants. Yeah. And it scares me to death. I'm just like, this animal does not want to be here. He's going to freak out. And so, like, I'm never getting on those things. But that was a mainstay. I mean, I think the Mule Pack lasted into the 60s. But the stagecoach and the Conestoga wagon, that stuff went away in like 59, 60. I mean, it didn't last very long because the horses were getting spooked all the time.
And horses have been sort of a mainstay at the Magic Kingdom ever since. Do you still have horses at Disneyland?
You do. You do. You have the ranch, the Triple D, where they keep the animals there. And at some point in time, they began to sort of, I don't know if this is the proper term, raise their own animals to use in the park and train them or whatever. And so, if I'm not mistaken, that's correct. The horses that pull the carriage around Main Street and stuff, that's all, you know, pretty common still at Disneyland.
Now, is there anything, guys, I'm missing from early Disneyland that we think should be mentioned in a sort of pre-Animal Kingdom sort of way?
Actually, Dave. there's another space in Disneyland that we have to mention. And in the 1.0 series, we sort of looked into this a little bit on Wedway Radio, and that's the Mickey Mouse Club Circus area. Are you familiar with this land?
Not at all.
This existed, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, where modern It's a Small World would be. So it's not anything like the Magic Kingdom, where It's a Small World is sort of housed in this sort of complex. It's a Small World has its own identity, has its own space.
Right.
With an independent building. And so out there beyond Fantasyland, you had this space here, and I believe that's where Mickey Mouse Club Circus was. But they did have circus animals, and it's really kind of a sad story. They had, like, these lions and tigers, and they were, like, in these
really
cages, and they were, like, sedated. It was like Yeah, it wasn't this was kind of a darker time, I think, for zoos, and, you know, maybe the same ethical treatment of animals wasn't there like it is today. But
Mike can talk about that.
That's certainly true, but you go ahead.
Yeah, so there was a lot of that stuff going on, and I think to some extent, animals were sort of used as a means to an end, if you will, to sort of tell the story of the land. This didn't last long either. I think it lasted like a year, maybe. Yeah. But they did have a couple of circus performances, and then they had like Keller's Jungle Killers was the name of one of the attractions there, with these like tigers, and like I said, they probably weren't in tip-top shape by the time you saw them.
Oh my god!
Yeah, it was rough. Little rough.
I used the Googles.
The Googles. And,
yes, apparently it was only from 1955 till 1956.
There you go.
So it was about a year. It was gone pretty quick.
It's probably good. I'm kind of glad that one like went away pretty fast.
So you're talking like a traditional old school animal abused.
I'm not going to say like it was abused, yeah. But I think a tiger in that environment, I don't know how well they would have been able to showcase it unless it was like in a different state of mind.
Right.
You know
right,
what I mean?
Right. A natural state of mind.
Yeah. So I guess by traditional terms, that's abuse, but it wasn't like, I don't think they were like smacking it around or anything.
So you have, in the very beginnings of Disneyland, you actually have some of the animals, live animals, that you now see at the Animal Kingdom, certainly in a different setting.
Yes.
But they are there, and that's amazing. I did not know that. I knew that they did some circus things at old Disneyland. I did not know that they actually brought in you know, dangerous animals, you know,
for a very limited time. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, elephants are dangerous, but people are very used to elephants in like you were saying, in zoos and things like that. But to have a tiger or a lion or a cheetah or something like that walking around Disneyland just does seem to be an idea that probably wasn't the best thought out thing in the world. Well, that's awesome. That's terrific. Matt, I can't thank you enough for doing this, because you really, I mean, just for our listeners, we're going to continue this series. Mike and I are going to do more on this stuff. There's a heck of a lot more to go in the animal world between where we're leaving here in the 1950s at Disneyland and when the park opened up in 98. But the two of us really needed somebody who had a good knowledge, not just because they went to Disneyland, but many times, but also of the other thing. I can't thank you enough for it.
You got it, man. I mean, it's really cool, I think, to build this sort of connectivity between what you find in a park like the Animal Kingdom, which I love, and relate it back to the early days of Disneyland and things they were trying to do at that time, but maybe didn't have the means or the space to do, and see how that plays out today. Because Animal Kingdom is such a lovely place to take your family that I think, you know, if Walt were here today, he would have loved this space and loved everything they've done with it.
And I also want to say this before we let you go. You and Nate at Wedway Radio, and if you people don't listen to Wedway Radio or Wedway Now, you don't know what you're missing, so go over there and subscribe right away, because they're fantastic shows. You guys were actually very instrumental in getting this show started, in getting our website started. You were incredible help, both of you, in getting everything up and running. And I just, for our listeners out there, I want all of you to know how much we thank you guys for what you've done for us over the years here. And I mean, really, we couldn't have started this without you.
You got it, man. I mean, I think that's the real strength of, you know, a lot of people in the Disney community here is that, you know, we help each other. We kind of look out for each other. Sometimes we make fun of each other or whatever, but it's all in good fun, right? And so the idea is here that we all have this thing that we love and we want to explore it further and help other people explore it further too. So I appreciate your, you're talking great about the show. Obviously, we've kind of gone through a lull here in the last 6 months or so, but we're ready to get things kicked back off on Wedway Radio. So, if you haven't listened to it, I really appreciate downloads and just come over and hang out with us for a while.
And if they can find you on iTunes, there's also websites for each of the two shows, correct?
Yeah, at least the one for now, the Wedway Radio, the big show, is right. We've kind of become the focus again. And I think you can find us on LinkedIn. We're not sure if we have a LinkedIn.
We're not sure.
It's kind of a running joke that we have. You can find us all over. Don't follow us on Twitter, though. If you're a baseball fan, you'll be very upset.
Well, not if you're a Royals fan.
Well, unless you're a Royals fan, then you'll love us to pieces. All six of you will love us.
And the Wedway Now show is still up and running?
It's breathing, man. Yeah. So we found that, and I think that you guys probably could speak to this, is that news doesn't necessarily warrant a weekly show anymore.
Right.
And so, you know, if we got on there and talked every single week about news, you know, we'd kind of just be spinning wheels from, you know, certain week to week. And, you know, we did that with the film show, too, is that we started it and then we had a lot of early topics. And then, you know, you go through spaces where there's not as much to talk about. So the big show is the focus, the history show. And, you know, we're looking forward to continuing to do that for however long we can.
How many episodes are you into that now?
Oh, Lord, I don't even remember. I mean, it's. It's over 200, I think, of the big show.
200 episodes of the most well-researched Disney history you're going to find in a podcast, folks. If you are a Disney fan, it's a Shangri-La podcast.
I got to tell you, Dave, and I think I mentioned this on our show one other time. Obviously I'm a subscriber, and one show popped up. It was Johnny Appleseed.
Oh,
yeah,
I know nothing about Johnny Appleseed. Never saw the movie. And I thought, why am I listening to this? An hour later, it was fascinating. It was, and all of a sudden I knew everything about Johnny Appleseed. And who the heck knew? It was all of that goodness coming out of that one movie. That one show said to me how great Wedway Radio is.
Well, I appreciate that. But I mean,
we're still waiting for the first Animal Kingdom episode. I mean,
so are we. Yeah, it's going to be huge. It's going to be like a 17-hour show of just Animal Kingdom. It's going to be the all kinds of stuff we're going to bring up on there. Mostly dinosaur, though.
Matt, thank you once again.
Hey, I appreciate it, guys, and I look forward to great things from you guys too. And I'm really happy that you guys sort of came together on this podcast too. You guys are doing good stuff, and the conservation effort that you guys put forth is something I respect as somebody in the Midwest who adopts dogs and whatever. I love it.
Oh, yes, awesome. We both adopt. I mean, I have an adopted dog too, so yeah, I do know you do that.
That's great.
Very cool. Well, thank you once again, and thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
And thanks once again for listening to Radio Harambe. Let me remind you to check out JomboEveryone.com. Over there you'll find links to our store where we're raising money for our conservation partners. You can find out more about our conservation effort. You can also find our links to Facebook and Twitter and Pinterest and all of those things. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can also find me on Twitter at Radio Harambe. Mike is at JomboEveryone. So you can follow us on there. Don't forget to review the show on iTunes as you can. Also, our sincerest thanks to Matt from Wedway Radio. If you are not listening to that show, you really ought to be. I don't know if we emphasized that enough during the interview there. Go to wedwayradio.com. You'll find links. They do two shows, a new show called Wedway Now, and also a great show about Disney history called Wedway Radio. So thanks once again to Matt for that, and check him out over there. So for Matt, for Safari Mike, I am Dave McBride. Kwaharini, go well, and thank you again for listening to Radio Harambe. Kwaku walu kwa mwako na kumbu.